Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 414. I just got back from the Breaking/Talking Bad finales, and I won't say anything. I promise I won't say anything, especially via, you know, because you may not have seen it yet. You should have, but maybe you didn't. But all I will say is,
spoiler alert, RJ has breakfast.
Shut up. He does not have breakfast. He does not have breakfast. She's not spoiling anything.
Always,
I mean,
has breakfast.
Yes, I know. Okay, so in our hearts, he'll
spoiler
always.
Spoiler alert, he stops having breakfast.
He doesn't stop having
Twist.
Breakfast. I don't. There's no.
Go back to your address.
I will.
Okay.
There's no. Listen, don't listen to Skydart. She's editing a video. She's very loopy. And she doesn't even know what she's saying at this
Maybe
point.
Maybe I should have had breakfast.
Are you on meth? Are you on meth?
Breakfast meth.
Oh my god. Meth is not just for breakfast anymore.
No.
That is a common mistake. It's an any time of day snack now.
Yep.
But if you did watch Talking Bad, thank you so much, and I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope that I didn't sully the Breaking Bad experience for you. It was an honor to do it, and tonally it was a lot different for me than Talking Dead, and even to be tangentially associated with Breaking Bad was a tremendous honor. So thanks if you watched it. And now 2 weeks until Talking Dead and Walking Dead, and then October 21st at midnight on Comedy Central. So that's where I'll be next on the Teleovision. That's a thing that looks like the internet, but it's bigger and you don't have control over it. I would like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Stamps.com is, I mean, I blab about this all the time, because I want you guys to lead happy, fulfilling lives, not having to do menial tasks like go to the post office. So Stamps.com will help you print out the exact postage that you need. They will send you a digital scale, which will calculate the exact postage that you need. And then you can just slap it on the package or letter or whatever the parcel or mail piece is. And then your mail carrier will pick it up. And you should thank them. You will never waste time going to the post office again. You're not going to waste money either leasing an expensive postage meter or waste money on stamps postage that you're not going to use. Right now and always, there is a promo code Nerdist. Remember it. You probably do, unless you skip over this part, which I hope you don't. It's a no-risk trial, $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale, to $55 of free postage. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Do not mail meth to people. Do not mail meth to people. This episode of the podcast is Mike Massimino, who is a friggin' astronaut and an engineer, and he's been to space. He repaired the Hubble telescope. I mean, Mike seems like a regular guy, but the fact is he is not a regular guy. He's an exceptionally smart individual who happens to just be relatable and fun, which is probably why you may have heard him on a number of episodes of Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, another guy who's incredibly smart but completely relatable. So I would put Mike Massimino into that bin were I to categorize him. And we had an absolute blast. And I blast! Rocket! Blast! Off! Huh? Chloe?
What?
Rocket blast?
Yeah, rocket blast.
Oh,
editing.
Go back to your meth jokes.
My specialty.
The Nerdist Podcast number 414 with Mike Massimino.
Mike Massimino?
Not Mike Massimino, Mike Massimino.
I got excited.
He understands mathematics. You understand mathematics.
I'm glad you added that in.
Shut up. No, I just said it.
Really? I love that you paused for like a minute. You're like, hold on, I gotta add this to the intro.
It was worth it.
Is it really?
No.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We're just talking about at the tweet up for the last shuttle launch. Mike got to do a Q&A with Elmo.
But it's kind of, we're talking to the guy, you know, because you're talking to the puppet.
Right.
Little Elmo's there. Very cute, you know.
Yeah, of course.
You know. And you can hear kind of on the loudspeaker, sort of. But you also can, the guy's close enough to the puppet that you can also hear his voice, right? So it was kind of strange because I can hear his voice coming from the side, and it's So after a while, I stopped looking at it. I said, no one's going to know what I'm really looking at. Yeah. I can change my gauge a few inches, my gaze a few inches. So I stopped looking at Elmo after a while and just looked at the guy. I was just talking to the dude. You know, the dude's up there, and he's, I don't know, sometimes he'd look at me, and I was like, well, you know, those are not like tracking my eye movements. They're not going to know. So I stopped looking at the puppet, and I talked to the guy. So
it's not a puppet. It's a person.
Oh, my gosh. Should the kids listen to this?
Oh, you ruined
kids,
it for
away.
Me. No, you ruined it for me. Oh, Mike.
Kids, it was Elmo's friend. I'm the guy that ruined Elmo.
It's good to see you, Mike. So you're in town promoting something because you're doing a crazy junket day.
Gravity.
Yeah.
Oh, you're promoting Gravity.
Yeah.
Were you a consultant on Gravity?
No, wasn't. We already covered this, Chris.
No, I was not a consultant
on
it.
Late to the party.
But I would like to think that George Clooney based his performance on my personality.
This is what Massimino would have done.
And I'm trying to get that message to my wife. She doesn't believe me.
Are there strip bolts in the movie? He's got to rip a panel off?
No, there's not. Well, they have some other issues. My worst day in space would have been a real easy day for these poor people. They have a tough day up.
What was your worst day in space?
My worst day in space. Well, I never really had a bad day in space, Chris. But we had problems to figure out.
Sure. Hubble problems.
It's going to seem meaningless compared to what you'll see on the screen. Yes, we had problems with Hubble where it had a handrail in the way that I had to rip off.
You had to rip apart the Hubble.
Had to
in
rip
space.
It apart because we had to get behind this handrail to do a repair, and there was no other way to do it. And we didn't figure that out for about an hour and a half. The most simple solution.
It's pretty amazing.
I understand that you have a lot of training.
Yes.
How do you not shit your spacesuit when you're just hovering above the Earth?
Well, there's something to catch the shit.
No, I understand.
There's a big incentive not to do that.
No, yes, of course.
It's not like, oh, I wish I could go and no.
But I really do believe that, I think, that... There are a lot of different ways that you can categorize people, but one way is spacewalker, like people that will go into space and people that would not go into space. I think I would be almost a little too claustrophobic to be able to handle just being sort of isolated and kind
of. Don't worry, you'll figure that out on the ground. throw you in the pool in Houston, you'll have a good time.
No one's gonna send me into space. It's like watching The Right Stuff when they're doing the trials. And like the one guy's freaking out because he's in isolation, and Dennis Quaid's just reading the magazine.
Yeah. My favorite movie.
It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
Did you have to train to be able to handle isolation? The idea of
bowel movements.
Bowel movements. Yeah. But the idea of a human being just like almost the existential crisis of I am above the place where I live, and like I'm existing outside of my normal. Habitat.
Right.
That's not, is that mind bendy, or are you just naturally of a low key cool guy?
I don't like heights, for example. I don't like looking over the balcony from a few floors. I don't like that. I don't get it. But up in space, it's so cool.
So constantly falling at 17,000 miles an hour, not a problem.
No, because, it's just that the view, when you see the planet from up there, you don't feel like you're really hovering over it. Even in I'm fine in airplanes too and all that, but it's just an incredible experience. That all that other crap, all your worry just kind of gets stomped on by, holy cow, what am I looking at?
Do you?
And that pure ecstasy of seeing that stuff. It just rules out any other fear.
So there is the concept of space euphoria.
Yes.
Where you go out there and you don't want to
come back.
There
is a concept. Did you just make it up?
No.
Made it up.
It's psychological studies. They've done this.
Okay.
And that was what happened with Ed White. He didn't want to come back in. On the first, in Gemini,
spacewalk?
When he got out,
uh-huh.
It took him, they asked him to come in, and it took them 20 minutes to get him to come in to Gemini. Because there's just this experience of like you can hear it too on the tapes. He says, I feel like a million bucks. And he's out there and he just didn't want to come in. Yeah. And then when he's getting in, he says, this is the saddest moment of my life.
Oh, wow. My God.
Yeah, see, they gave him the treat and then they took it away. That's the problem.
I mean, it is pretty interesting to think that there are only a handful of people out of billions that will ever really have what you have in your brain. That will only ever have the actual view,
right.
You know, not a satellite image, but actually have that view and that experience of being up there and looking down.
We're very lucky.
At least until privatized space travel.
Yeah, wait around a couple months and then it'll be
but
a diamond.
But for now,
yeah.
it's pretty incredible.
No, I'm very, very lucky. And to get to spacewalk and see it, so you're not looking through a window, you're looking through the visor and you can see the Earth in its entirety from the – altitude of Hubble. Hubble's at 350 miles, so 100 miles higher than the station. So we get a bigger view of the planet. We can see the curvature. We see it as a gigantic planet. It takes up our field of view, but we get that perspective. And we're very, very fortunate to have gotten a chance to see it.
It's crazy.
And, you know, you want to be more grateful that you've seen it than I can't see it. You know?
Right. Yeah,
I may
not
see it again. You know?
Yeah.
So I was happy to come inside and a little bit sad that I couldn't see it, but very, very happy that I had a chance to experience it.
Well, you know, Matt is I don't know if there's a bigger NASA nerd than Matt Myra.
Yeah,
right really?
Here.
Right here,
yeah,
Matt?
I'm right up there, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Who's your favorite Apollo-era astronaut? Let's figure this out.
I've gotten a chance to meet a lot of them. You know, when I was
there's only one answer to this. I'm just
going
to figure out. No.
Okay, well, my favorite, I guess I know him the best, is Alan Bean.
I've become friends with Alan Bean.
So he lives in Houston, and we've become friends. He's a terrific
guy.
His paintings, no. I can't afford any of his paintings. But I did fly. I flew for him one of his paintings. It kind of reminds me of the thing you got hanging on your wall with your three buddies there. He has something called, he calls Fantasy, where it's he and Pete Conrad run a moon together, and their good friend, Dick Gordon was the pilot who didn't get to go on the moon with them.
Right.
But they were really tight. They were three good friends. And so he painted the three of them on the moon together. And that was his wish that the three of them could be together. So I really liked that concept. And before I flew my most recent flight, I went to visit Alan. I said, I want to take something for you. And I said, I can, you know, put something in my notebook for you. And he said, well, you know, he would like that image. That was the one I had in mind. So I took a printout of that, and it was just a printout.
Oh,
not a real.
Yeah. Well, that's too big.
But he's a cool dude. Alan's a great guy, but I've been very lucky to meet Neil Armstrong and Jim Lovell and Pete Conrad, Charlie
Mike Collins.
Duke.
You ever meet Mike
I met
Collins?
Mike Collins, yeah.
He's my favorite.
He was my favorite when I was a little boy because he had the same first name as me.
Okay.
So that was my rationale back then. But they're all really cool dudes, all of them.
They are.
What do you like? Why do you like Mike Collins?
Whenever you see him interviewed, he just seems the most normal. Like, he's like, meh, we went up.
he's very blasé,
he's just you know. People ask, how'd you feel being the furthest away from all of humanity?
Yeah.
I said, I don't know.
I was had to be somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, someone had to be up there. Someone had to catch him.
I will always be fascinated by that kind of a brain, where someone could just be like, it's fine.
Yeah,
whatever.
The ultimate cool fighter test pilot guy.
Yeah, it's the military training, you got to think. And then my other favorite would be John Young, I think.
John Young's a cool guy.
He flew everything.
I knew I was going to leave out somebody. Not that they would really care what I thought, but
they've been to the moon.
But John Young, John Young's but I got to know him very well because he was still an active astronaut when I joined in 1996.
It's insane.
He was in his 60s. He was still flying a T-38. So here's my boyhood hero, and now I'm working with him. And he was a front seat pilot, so the T-38, our training jet, was a front and back airplane. And I said, anytime you need someone to go with you somewhere, let me know. And he was like, okay. And he would let me know. So I got to fly to the Cape Canaveral with him and to California with him and ask him questions.
You ever drive on John Young Parkway with him in Florida?
No, I've never done that. I've driven by John Young Parkway. But he's a cool guy.
So
he's a great guy.
You started at Johnson Space Center, right?
I did. That's where we trained. That's it.
I've been to Johnson Space Center, but I didn't. I failed.
You visited. You didn't tell me.
Well, this was ages ago.
I get this crap from my relative. You were here and you didn't tell me. That's why.
This was like 7 years ago.
All right, okay.
This was before.
You would tell me.
No. Now I would absolutely tell you if I want to go down there because I didn't actually have time to take the tour of the grounds. We just saw the main. Like you just go in.
Yeah.
And it's really a lot of it's like there's the a cross section of the shuttle.
Yeah.
But a lot of it really is sort of like a jungle gym.
It is. It's a playground.
Yeah, it's sort of a playground. I was like, oh, man, I thought there was going to be, some spacier things here. And they said, well, you have to take the tour of the grounds. You have to see the launch pad, and you have to see everything.
Yeah, I've never been.
So, but it's cool. I really – well, we'll go. Like, I'm sure we'll play Houston sometime. And
we'll
go down there.
Sounds Let me know.
Yeah, I would absolutely.
If you want.
Do we get a special snazzy tour?
You betcha.
Oh.
I'll take good care of you.
How tall are you? That's my question.
I'm 6'3".
Are you like the tallest astronaut?
There's one guy, my buddy, good friend, Commander Scott Altman, is a little bit taller than I am. But 6'4" is the limit, so they're not going to be any much bigger than him.
See, because they're usually tiny.
You have to cram into it. Yeah, because you have to cram into a tiny cabin.
Yeah, you got
to
get into small spaces. So yeah, that's where they cut the limit off. But before that, the Apollo guys and the original astronauts were shorter based on the size of the capsule they were flying in.
Yeah,
based on their spacecraft size. So the shuttle opened up the window to larger and smaller people. It opened the envelope up.
Not me. Too long.
Why not?
That's me over there, fatstronaut right there.
That's you? Yeah, but you can, you know, you get whipped into shape. Just, you know.
What's the weight limit? That's my question.
I don't really know if there was with the shuttle. I think the weight limit's like 212 for the Soyuz, though.
All right, I can do that, I think.
You think you can do 212?
Yeah, it's like get down 70 to that? More pounds, 60 more pounds. I can do that.
Yeah, it'd be good for you.
Yeah.
Just don't lose your personality.
Get down to your Soyuz weight.
Yeah, that's it. Put the line on the scale.
Isn't that terrifying, Soyuz. Though, that like that's what we're using now, the Apollo era Russian version?
As the Soyuz.
Before, actually. It's been upgraded a few times, but it's been around a long time.
Ugh. Have you been to Star City?
It works. I have not. I'm like, both of my flights were to the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah.
So I have never been. I have never been there. I think I'm like the only astronaut that has never been there.
We should go sometime, me and you.
I'll go. Let's go.
I want to go to Star City.
I can't promise a good tour there. I'm not there, but I'm sure I can arrange something.
So what? I've seen you. Well, I saw you on Star Talk when the video version, like when Neil did Star Talk, and heard you on Star Talk too. And you're, you know, it's. I don't know. You have a real kind of like I'm a kind of a regular guy vibe to you. But
coming from you, I'm very flattered.
No, but seriously, because if I just met you at a party, I go, that guy's really nice. What does he do? He's an astronaut, an engineer, a pilot. Like, oh my God, really?
That's why Mike is my favorite shuttle era astronaut. That's true. You are.
Really?
Yeah.
You're making
again, in interviews, I'm
the only guy you know.
Can I tell you, last year, you stopped by my birthday party.
Oh, it was the best.
So much fun.
It was great.
You stopped by my birthday party.
Were you there, Matt?
No.
It was fantastic. All right, that's another story.
And so
was a blast. What a party.
Yeah, I sent Matt a picture because Bobat came. And so I sent Matt a picture because you were out of town.
No, I'll tell you exactly what happened. Reason to miss meeting Mike of all time. I had hosted Attack of the Show that day.
On G4.
And we decided to microwave beef.
Oh, you were sick. You had food poisoning. I remember that.
I do too.
And so I had to sit. I sent you. You ate microwaved beef.
We microwaved it during the commercial break. There was this very funny internet video with this weird guy on a college cable station that was he did recipes with a microwave.
Wow.
So he showed you how to make some killer nachos.
Oh.
So I decided.
Oh, no. Oh, so they really got sick.
Nachos.
Yeah. Oh, for crying out loud, Matt.
So you were violently ill. I remember this now. And I sent you a picture of Mike, and you were like, no! He was so heartbroken because you were just in town for like a day.
It was a real. But that kind of episode could help you get down to Soyuz weight.
Yeah,
that's the only silver lining on
the microwave beef diet.
I'm down 30 since July. I can do it.
You look good, man.
Six more months.
You look good.
Soyuz. We're gonna do it.
You look good.
We're gonna get on
Soyuz.
But anyway, that proves that Matt is an enormous fan of yours, and he was heartbroken that he couldn't come to that party.
I got to meet Winnie Cooper at that party.
Yes, Danica was.
I was
that's
afraid.
What you come away with,
I was afraid
Danica.
My life was over at that point because I was like, "There's really nothing else to live for."
What was so?
And she was so sweet. What a great,
best
person.
And what's amazing about that party? And I'm sorry to get name droppy, but it's relevant to the conversation. Is that was watching all these people nerd out and fan out on other people. Like, so you said you met Winnie Cooper. Danica freaked out about meeting Bill Nye.
Really?
Yeah, Bill Nye freaked out about meeting, I think, Nathan Fillion. Like, it was just like the chain of each person and watching him go, oh my God, you're so-and-so, and that person walking over to someone else and going, oh my God, you're so... Like, it was
Well,
a fun...
Well, this November, I will not be microwaving anything before your birthday.
Well, we don't know if Mike's going to be back in town in November.
You'll probably be like, oh, you missed it. Mike Collins came out of retirement to come to my party.
He came out of... Why does he have to be out of retirement to go to a party?
I don't know. It's a long way. He lives in Florida and Cape Cod.
So getting on a plane at this point is coming out of retirement. You pop back and forth in Los Angeles a lot, right?
I do. I like I come in here. It's
you know
usually,
what?
It's usually for fun and games.
You are on this podcast because I saw you on Twitter saying you were doing press for Gravity. And
really?
I texted Booker.
A lot of times people, you know, they give me, I get grief when I Twitter them somewhere. They're like, why didn't you come visit? Why didn't you call? So I'm glad it worked out. But no, it's fun coming out here. And it's there's a lot of media attention here promoting the movie Gravity. I don't know if we're really promoting it, but we're trying to represent NASA and spread the word. And this is a great place to do it.
So is it? So do you feel like it's is NASA kind of going through a phase where they're like, well, you know, we've taken some hits in the press because of funding for the space program, so we kind of need to keep our, you know, get our name out there and show that we're still active and show that we're still doing
stuff? Well, I think they want to show people that, yeah, they're still alive. You know, we don't have the shuttle program any longer, and NASA was identified with that. But, you know, mentioned Bobek. You know, we've got the Mars rover going strong.
Yeah.
And we've got people going to the space station. You know, we just got Chris Cassidy back.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got Mike Hopkins is going to be going. We launched from Russia.
Yeah.
From Kazakhstan. So it's a different experience. But, you know, they're still going up. It's a different way to get there. But the end result is pretty much the same. You're in space for 6 months on the space station.
Wow.
So we're trying to get the word out that, you know, we're still sending people to space. We're designing new spaceships. We're working with some of these commercial companies. You know, we want people to know that we're still doing stuff. And people that are interested, you know, I had the dream of being an astronaut when I was a little kid. You can still have that dream. Even you, Matt.
Oh, my God.
You can do it, buddy. It's not too late. Are you what are the effects after you've been in the space station for 6 months? What are the effects to the body, like in terms of, or either, you know, bone density loss,
yeah,
or I mean just the effect of not having any kind of grounded?
Yeah, it's like being I've never done that experience. I've been on shuttle missions 2 weeks to the Hubble has been my spaceflight career so far. But my, you know, a lot of my friends have gone and done the station on shuttle, and also the long duration 6 month stay that you're talking about. There, you've hit it right on the head though. You're worried about muscle loss. You're worried about bone density loss. So they exercise every day, 6 days a week. It's a 2 hour period. That
Me
includes
too,
your.
I'm not even in space.
Oh, I watched the Hadfield videos. I watched all the.
Did he show you all that?
It was who took over for Hadfield? What was her name?
Oh, Karen Nyberg.
Yes, she did a tour. Someone mm-hmm. did a tour and it was like,
yeah.
And it was hilarious because she was explaining like how the bathrooms work.
Yeah, yeah.
But in a very real way, like,
yeah,
it's tough and it's messy and it's
it could be. You got to be careful. That's why you want to be careful when you're in space. Yeah,
and then seeing the, you know, the treadmill,
yeah,
and, you know, and just a lot of things, yeah, that we take for granted, just that you have to be very cognizant of when you're up there, because anything could become a projectile.
Right. Now, there's things that could be floating around, and if you use your imagination not too much, you can say, well, that's something I really don't want to be floating around. You talked about getting sick with the microwave beef.
Yeah, sure.
Can you imagine how you get sick from the other end of the microwave beef?
Ooh.
So you want to be really careful.
Rough.
You want to be really careful with that sort of thing. So yeah, the hygiene is really important, and keeping a clean ship is really important, and exercise is very important to keep you healthy. And that's the best way to counteract it, is to exercise. And we have, even though you can't lift weights in space, we have a resistive exercise device that allows, it works on a series
of Bowflex,
more or less, almost kind of, but it's a really fancy one. And we have a treadmill and a bike to ride, and all that stuff is important to do.
So many great things were designed by NASA. Like, we just were seeing all the old advertisements.
Yes.
You know, Tempur-Pedic or space pens or whatever, designed by NASA.
Yeah.
For, you know, that's really where the cutting edge of technology is.
There you go.
Was.
Velcro.
Velcro.
Velcro's great. Without Velcro, how would old people have shoes?
They...
Hey, I'm getting close, Matt. Don't diss the Velcro, buddy. You can do a lot with Velcro.
That's great. Velcro's great.
And it really, you know, NASA, I think, to a whole generation of us, really does represent, you know, like hope and sort of cutting edge technology and you know, onward, that kind of feeling. And so do you feel like NASA is still, does it still mean that to this young generation, or is the onus on you guys to really figure out a way to reach young people and get the message out?
Well, I think a couple things. One is, I think what you guys are doing and being kind of a science oriented program personality, I think that you get a lot of that message out to the younger people. But I tell you what, you know, I the last couple of years I've had some interesting experience. I've been on assignment, more or less, Still with NASA, but I was at Rice University for a few months.
Yeah.
And now I'm up in New York City at Columbia University for a little while, and like a visiting faculty member. Still a NASA person, but up there working for a temporary assignment. And these students, these are smart kids, young kids. They are just as excited about spaceflight as I was back in the day. And I was kind of shocked because I had the same assumption. You know, hey, no one's walking on a moon. We don't have a space shuttle. These kids are going to forget about what's going on. But there is just as much, I think, just as much excitement with these young people today. I think it's the way we can share information. You know, they may not see people walking on the moon, but they see a lot on the internet. They hear your program. They hear a lot of science, math, spaceflight. Danica's books, right?
Yes,
Cooper's
yes.
books. You know, all that stuff. It's become kind of cool. The Big Bang Theory. You know, I got a chance to be on that show.
Yeah.
Launching into space. So I've never been on the space station, but in The Big Bang Theory, I was.
You're on the space station.
So I'm going to count that as a
I had to pick one.
You would pick The Big Bang Theory?
Oh, God, no.
All right, okay.
He would pick the space station.
The space station.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of excitement with the young
space
people
station's
today.
Probably funnier, too.
You know what anyway. I don't... Hey, you know what I don't... what I didn't know, and I feel like an idiot for not knowing this, but I feel like a lot of people didn't know this. It seemed like the reaction was kind of surprised. Was it when... when the rover went landed on Mars,
mm-hmm.
Someone pointed out on Reddit, like, oh, you know, there was a device on Venus in the 70s, and I had
really?
No idea. There was a device like that. They basically, I think it maybe the Russians, someone landed a device on Venus in the 70s, and it took these very sort of grainy.
Yeah. We certainly have photos. Yeah.
And I had no idea. I had no idea.
Yeah, we don't. Yeah, it's. It's interesting how the rover captured everyone's attention. You know, I think Bobak with his mohawk had something
to
do with it.
The mohawk had...
I think that we could blame him for it or give him the credit, maybe. But it's interesting because, yeah, we have landed space. There's been other rovers on Mars.
Yeah.
There's been, you know, exploration of the moon, the solar system. Voyager's way, way out there.
Voyager just broke the...
Just went out there.
Yeah, just got out of the solar system.
Yeah, so all that's happened, right? So I almost ask you guys, I mean, why has that happened? I think it's because of all the... You know, maybe the social media or the news gets out or what we're able to share. I don't know, because that it really captured people's imagination. The Bobak's like a rock star, and
I think a
the
lot
whole
of
Mars
it,
team
well,
got a lot of press, a lot of excitement.
Well, how fast information was traveling.
Not only how fast, but also the fidelity, like the quality of the information we're receiving, the pictures,
right.
This
is good.
The
fact that it was live streamed on Xbox.
I mean, I watched it on Xbox. You know, and with Voyager, I know Voyager's not sending images back anymore, but it's sending back, you know, I guess atmospheric, but it's sending back data of, you know.
Oh, we'll find out when it gets taken over and turns into its own intelligent V'ger.
And then and then transforms.
Yeah, and then takes that bald girl off the bridge of the Enterprise.
Is there any way? Where is it? Just sort of in a dead zone in between solar systems at the moment, or what is in the dead space between?
You know, it's still pretty close to our solar system, right? So I still think the sun is going to be its most. The biggest object out there that's going to influence what it's doing with itself. If it kept going, eventually it might be captured by the gravity of something else. And it's a good question because I don't know what else could capture it out there and how long it would take for it to get to a spot where, you know, something else is going to start tugging on it. But basically it's this ballet going on out there with solar systems and galaxies that make up the universe. And gravity is pulling on is like this balance, and gravity's pulling in his energy. You know, this concept of dark energy pushing on things. So all that is going on. So I guess my assumption would be that Voyager's still within the grasp of the sun, as it's the largest object that is going to hold it in place until it gets far enough away that something else is going to be tugging on it. And I don't know what that something.
And
else
essentially,
is.
It's just it's running on something about the. As powerful as a car battery, right? I mean, it's probably about right.
Yeah,
yeah. For the last 35 years,
it's amazing. You know, once you get some speed, you know, as long as you can keep going, and you get out there, you can go a long way. But it may take you a long time.
it's been out there for a while. There's no atmosphere to really degrade.
No, there's no drag.
There's no drag. There's no friction. There's no anything to really. It's just
none's going
to
stop
a vacuum.
That thing.
Yeah, it's just
going to keep even if it dies so that its batteries run out. That thing's going to keep going until something else captures it.
Wow,
someone's going to find it.
It may be a dead spacecraft at some point if it runs out of juice. But it's going to nothing. It's that the powers
for a second
of the universe,
there, I thought you were saying like maybe it'll run into another dead spacecraft.
Oh,
like,
I don't know. Kaboom! No, I think it's going to. Who knows? But it'll keep going.
It does.
I almost get anxious thinking about. I've had just sort of weird dreams about just. where that thing is and just the isolation of being at the edge of the solar system.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, I mean, I know you're involved with Gravity, the movie Gravity, but when I saw the, I moderated the panel for it at Comic-Con in San Diego and I...
Yeah, they mentioned it. Yes. They liked what you did.
Oh,
actually.
They were great. Nice. They were great. And so I saw the extent, you know, like they showed some footage from the movie.
Yeah.
And it's terrifying. Like, just the idea. It's so...
That's what I was saying. It's edge of your seat bullshit. I can't take that.
Remember, it's a movie, man.
I know.
No, it's real. It's real. When did you... You grew up in New York.
Yeah.
And did you immediately know, like, high school, college, like, you know, this is where I want to go? Or would you just think, well, I'm going to be an engineer, but maybe I'll be a pilot or...
Well, when I was 6 years old when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, right? So I can remember that, and that got my attention when I was a little kid. And I've got a picture of me dressed up in a astronaut costume my mother made that summer for me because I wanted to play astronaut. She actually converted like an elephant costume that I wore in the school play. I had no talent. You know,
so you wore that the first time you went up, right?
I would have, but I outgrew it.
Strong enough.
Yeah, okay. I outgrew it, and it's made out of polyester. Polyester was the wonder material back then, yeah. But our spacesuits are made out of different materials
to keep us safe. Good. Yeah.
So, but that's what I wanted to know. You mentioned high school. I didn't know I was a high school student. What did I know?
Yeah.
I knew I liked math and science better than I liked English. No offense to the English majors, but, you know, I was more interested in math.
You like where there are answers?
I like the, exactly. I was able to do that. You know, the English, like, what do I do? So I decided that I was going to, you know, study engineering in college when I looked at what I was going to. But when I was a senior in college, I saw the movie The Right Stuff.
Yeah.
That came out, and it's going to be 30 years, I think, that movie's been released coming up this year.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
Really?
Yeah. Right. So, I'm coming up on my, believe it or not. Yeah. And that really caught my attention and kind of rekindled the dream. And I worked for a couple years in New York City. When I graduated Columbia University, is where I went as an undergrad. And when I got out of there, I worked for a couple years, and then I went to grad school at MIT with the idea that, as you said, maybe becoming an engineer. I think the astronaut thing is ridiculous to try to, you know, if you look at the odds, it's ridiculous. And most recently, we had, I think, like 6,800 applicants. We chose 8.
Wow.
Yeah, the most recent class. So it's very, very difficult to actually get chosen. And we had better odds. They put 35 in my astronaut class. So it was 35 Americans. So it was a greater chance to get selected back then. But I always knew that the chances were slim. And that I had to enjoy what I was doing. So the idea of being an engineer or someone working in the space program, that's what I wanted to do. If I couldn't go, I wanted to help other people go. But I always had, you know, I was still aiming high. I always had the dream of being an astronaut. You know, when I was a little boy, then it kind of left me and it came back when I was in college at Columbia. And then that's when I started to pursue it.
Wow. The astronauts are an interesting group because I always just sort of saw them as like, they're brain jocks. They're like, they're sort of, you know, they're in good shape, and they seem kind of like, you know, they seem sort of athletic and, you know, military, but also at the same time, like, they're also kind of scientists, too.
Say anything to that. I don't want to burst the bubble. But that's a very nice description. Thank you. We'll go with that.
Okay, good.
What was your PhD in?
Mechanical engineering.
See? Proved my point.
See that?
You have a PhD in mechanical engineering. You're like, I went to grad school at MIT, I have a PhD in mechanical engineering.
Do you ever introduce yourself to people as Dr. Astronaut?
No, because then they start asking, then they expect stuff. Really? Can you solve this equation? You know, first, if you say doctor, they want a prescription. I say, no, I'm a PhD. Well, I want an answer to this solution. I'm like, no, I don't know. So leave me alone. I try to keep it quiet.
So how did that, you know, like, where is the balance between this sort of the physical demands and then obviously the mental demands of the job too? Like, how do you find the balance between those two when you're in space and you're on a spacewalk and you have to rip a panel off to solve a problem?
Chris, they're really both very important. The better shape you can be in, the better chances of success you're going to have. For example, on a spacewalk, we have these like athletic trainers, they call, you know, called them gym teachers. We have these gym teachers in our, and one of them was, you know, was Beth Shepard. Before my first flight, she told me, you know, what you're going to do in a spacewalk is similar to someone who's going to run a marathon or play an overtime professional football game or something like that, where you're going to be going long and you've got to be good at the end just as you are at the beginning. And she said that she thought that most professional games that were decided in overtime, once you get past, you know, the regulation and you're in overtime, she said that most of those are based, she thought, on two things. One was nutrition and the other one was fitness. And that's what's going to win those games at the end. Who has more stamina and who's eating well? So she says, you got to eat well and you got to take care of yourself and you got to be in good shape. And I remember her saying that. And I think that that's pretty accurate, because once you get down to, if you're going overtime on your spacewalks, and we had some long spacewalks on Hubble, you know, you're really starting to reach there. So you want to be in as best shape you can, and you want to be eating well and trying to be healthy. And then the mental part of it is really important. You want to be able to think about things that are going to help you. You know, it's not like we're wizards and we can figure out all these different problems, but you want to think, you know, what do I need to solve this problem? How am I going to solve this problem? How am I going to work with my friends to solve this problem? What information is available to me to help me do my job? So I remember hearing a story about Neil Armstrong, that he could tell how fast he was going along the moon by timing the craters below him. Like, he knew how fast he was going. He could use that as an extra cue. So not that I did that, that's pretty cool, but you know, I would try to use whatever I could available to me and work as a team. And the teamwork thing, I think, is, you know, a lot of people say, well, how the heck did you become an astronaut? You seem like a guy that should be working in a deli, you know? You know, and there's nothing wrong with guys working in a deli, but, you know, I think that would be a pretty cool career, you know, working in an Italian deli, dishing out cold cuts or whatever, you know, working and doing whatever.
Yeah.
And but I think
we got,
you know,
a nice prosciutto this week.
Like, if you went back and said, "Yeah, you got right, go ask my friends that went to school." I'm like, "How did you?" Like, "Well, we don't know."
Hey, Dr. Butcher.
Yeah, Dr. Butcher. What do you got? What's that? What's that? They say I'm a doctor. Well, what's that provolone made out of? I don't know. Give me the equation for the provolone. But I think what people don't always appreciate is that the teamwork aspect of it is really important. You might be, you know, we're not necessarily looking for the smartest people, obviously. No, but I mean, you're looking for people that are bright enough, skilled enough to do the job. But it's also, I think, that element of being able to work as a team and someone you'd want to hang out with, someone you want to work with,
yeah,
which doesn't always show itself when you're looking for an astronaut.
But when you're up there and you're faced with, well, like, this panel, I'm going to have to rip it off and I got to get in there. I mean, is there any part of you that says, like, I may not be able to do this, or are you one of those people that just says, no matter what, I'm going to figure this out one way or another?
Once they told me that solution, Chris, I knew I could do that. It was when they were getting the complicated stuff that required a lot of thinking. Yeah. I wasn't so sure how we were going to figure it out. But when it came down to, let's see, they said it was 60 pounds of force that it was going to take. Some smart guys at the Goddard Space Flight Center, our team, our engineers were there. It's kind of like I think it was like the scene out of Apollo 13.
Yeah, run a vacuum cleaner on 10 amps, John.
These guys had it going into action. They had a copy of our instrument. They had all of our tools. It was a Sunday, and they replicated that problem. They came up with the idea to try to rip that handrail off, and they measured 60 pounds of force. The smart thing they did is they didn't give the video of that to Houston, because I saw the video after, and when they pulled that handrail off, it goes flying into the air.
Yeah.
So they would have been pretty concerned if that thing would have, you know, got me in the head. But we were really careful about how we pulled it off. And once I heard it was 60 pounds of force, I knew I had that. And I was very motivated to get that thing out of the way.
Well, you were, how far into the walk were you?
It was a few hours in. You try to plan for about 6.5 hours, and we were going to be right on the mark if everything went well. You can sometimes, we extended to about 8, but we were eating up over an hour just working that problem. The other thing I thought of, Chris, when that was going on, and Matt, for my training, that people said, what were you thinking of when you ripped that thing off? I lived across the street from my uncle Frank. And when I was about 10 years old playing stoop ball, he comes over the house covered in oil, right? And he goes, where's your father? And I go, he's in the house. He goes in my house all, you know, dripping oil, and they come out of the house. My father has about a 3-foot-long screwdriver. He grew up on a farm, and he took the screwdriver with him to the suburbs, like a tractor screwdriver. And he goes to me, come with me. You might learn something. I was 10 years old. He takes that screwdriver, because he knocks it through my uncle's oil filter, and he steps aside. My uncle grabs a rag and gets on that 3-foot screwdriver and starts yanking and cursing. I can't say what he said, but he starts yanking and cursing and breaks that thing through. And I swear to you, I was in space and I was getting ready, and I grabbed that handrail and go, this one's for you, Uncle Frank.
Oh! Whammo!
All right, so you never know. So kids, when your dad says, come with me, you might learn something, don't keep playing stoop ball. Go across the street and see what's going on. You never know when it's going to come in handy.
Well, yeah, when Uncle Frank tells you, you got to come back to the car and I'll show you something.
That's it.
Like, it could be something really bad, but in this case, it was really,
you know
it could have been, here's how to dispose of a body, here's how you launder money, you know, but whatever.
What?
Well, I think one of the reasons why you feel very familiar to me, because my mom's side of the family is Italian and my grandfather, my grandfather's family. My grandfather was one of 12 Italian. His parents were from Italy.
All right.
And so they were, you know, they were immigrants, and they and he was one of 12. And they grew up in Jersey. And
oh,
so,
there you go.
So I have all this whole side of the family that kind of has that, like, oh, and then Uncle Fred. And I actually... You know, I had an Uncle Gene who was a mechanic. Like, it just, you know, it's like, that just feels like, no, come on. Here's how you get, you roll up your sleeves, you get in there, and this is how you get shit done.
Yeah. My Uncle Joe LaPiccolo, was, he thought he could, we had a problem on the space shuttle. On my first one, we had a cooling problem. He's like a refrigeration air conditioning guy.
Yeah.
I swear to God, he's like, I was trying to get a hold of you. I wish I could have told you. I didn't think I knew what the problem was, right, Uncle Joe? But everyone, you grow up in a family like that, everyone can contribute.
I also had an Uncle Joe, and by the way, that's one thing that Italians do is when they're talking about people, they say their full name. And my Uncle Joey Fasseni, like they always say the full name.
You know why? Because you got about 15 of them.
15 Uncle Joe.
Because names are like, it's like a, you know, it spreads.
Five of them.
It spreads like a disease. You name one kid, you know, and they just, everyone's in line. Yeah. Like 100 Sals, and each family's different. This is like, you know, this is, everyone here is, you know, Sal and Anna. This is Peter and Mary. That's that. And everyone's named Pete or Petey. You know, they varied a little bit.
Don't even get me started on the Anthonys.
The Anthonys, exactly. Anthony's,
yeah.
It's 15 ways to say Giuseppe, Joseph, or Peppino, and it's old Joseph.
My great-grandfather was Giuseppe. My great-grandmother was Maria.
There you go. So you get something. That's what it is. It just repeats itself because they keep naming the kids the same stuff out of respect.
My grandmother was Regina Pinocchio.
Oh. Really?
About as Italian.
Pinocchio or Pinocchio?
Pinocchio. What was your question you're about to
ask? Oh, I was going
to
ask, were both of your flights on Atlantis?
No, my first one was on Columbia. Yeah, good memory. Yeah, or done your homework or something. Yeah, Columbia. We were the flight prior to losing Columbia was my first flight. Yeah. And then Atlantis was my second one.
There are probably no words to describe the tragedy, you know, the second shuttle tragedy. And then does any part of you say, like, we have to go up again as quickly as possible to let everyone know that it's okay? Or was it sort of like, oh, were you nervous about it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Chris, because, you know, if it didn't happen, I don't know how I would have reacted. So I can tell you how it actually went down. First of all, it was bad. It was like losing your best friends all along. It was a nightmare. I mean, looking back at that time, I thought I was living, you know, I was like out of body, living a nightmare.
And one of the most, I think one of the most chilling aspects to a shuttle disaster is that the entire world is watching it happen at once.
Yeah, everyone started watching. I don't know if everyone was, you know, their entry came in and, you know, it started going bad. And then everyone noticed what, it gets a lot of attention. President of the United States was at the Johnson Space Center with us the day after. And it was lots of media press. The whole world, you know, immediately turned their attention to what had happened. It's one of those big events that people remember. Where they were, you guys probably remember.
Of
where
course,
you were.
I was walking out of the church after we were burying my grandfather.
There you go.
And someone was like,
"There you go." It was
Columbia
a Saturday morning.
I was like, "Oh my god!"
Yeah. So people, it's one of those types of. Yeah, you're right. It brings a lot of attention, which is really weird, you know, because it's like you kind of have this our lives down there, and then all of a sudden it's like everyone's paying attention, and it's like the world is paying attention. So that's weird. But as far as, like, you know, the reaction to it, I had flown one time in space. And I came back from that flight saying, I really want to go back again. And if I had an opportunity, I want to go back to Hubble. You know, I felt, you know, once was kind of like, I was a rookie. I didn't really, you know, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I really want to go back again. I want to enjoy it. There's certain things I want to appreciate. And I only felt like it wasn't enough. You know, I don't know if you ever say it's enough, but I certainly felt like one was not enough. I wanted to go again. And it's not like it in a strange way, it didn't add any new information. You know, we knew that this could happen and we hadn't had an accident for a while.
Yeah.
Challenger, right?
Challenger was in 1986. This one happened in 2003, 17 years later, right? This was almost at the day, actually, was when that next accident happened. And you kind of knew that, you know, something's out there lurking. We thought on my first flight, dwelled on it, but when we first started talking about our spacewalks, I was a rookie. And the other guys who I spacewalked with, there was four spacewalkers on that flight. We're all veterans. They had a lot of experience. And we talked about amongst ourselves, our first little meeting getting together is that, you know, we lost a crew on launch, on ascent. You know, most likely we thought that the next time you're going to lose somebody would be during a spacewalk, because there's lots of things can go wrong in a spacewalk. And we're going to make sure that we take care of each other. We don't make any mistakes. We're going to cover each other. We don't want to come home. And that we really made sure that we knew our equipment well, the procedures well. We thought of every emergency we could do. We want to be prepared. We weren't really thinking. We thought entry was going to be okay. And then we found out in Columbia entry was bad. As well, I mean, we knew it could happen, but I guess what I'm saying is you always know that danger is out there. And the strangest thing was is that it really didn't change my desire to go. And after like a couple months, I spoke to my wife about it, and I said, you know, how do you... And we knew all those people. I mean, we were in their homes that night, you know, at the night of the accident. My kids knew their kids. Our wives were friends. You know, these were, this was like we lost family members, right? And I remember talking to my wife about this a couple months after, and I go, how do you feel about me flying again? And she's like, you've only gone once. Don't you want to go again? And I was like, yeah, you know, and it was, that was the thing to do. So it really didn't add. We knew it's there. It's still there. You know, I hate to say this, but we're probably going to lose somebody else eventually if we keep going. But, you know, you gotta keep going, right? You can't stop.
And what do you think is the ultimate, like, what is it that keeps pulling us into space?
I just think it's where we belong. I think it's our destiny. I think, you know, that's, for me, it was a dream to do it. And, you know, a dream is worth risk. I think, you know, you need to be passionate about what you're doing. And if it involves some risk, that's what it is. Let's try to minimize, but let's go on. But I just think it's where we're going to be. It's where, you know, we're adventurous. We're curious. I think it's our next step. You know, if you look at our evolution of where we're headed, it's the next thing out there is you know, what's going on out in our universe.
Do you think it's colonizing, like, ultimately? Thousands of years colonizing and leapfrogging across?
I think it's just leaving the planet and finding out what else is out there. We can send spacecraft beyond our solar system now, right? You know, we've got Voyager out there. But I think we're also going to want to send people. We're going to want to experience it. I think we can try to justify that and say, well, you know, luckily we had me to rip off that handrail, right?
Yeah.
A robot couldn't have done that. If you had no, you know, that, you know, it wouldn't have been, you couldn't improvise. So there are some practical reasons to have people there. But I think it's also about experiencing it firsthand and having people on the scene and trying to live off the planet. I think it's ultimately about leaving the planet. And I think we have options, and I think we're going to pick one and do it. Either it's going to be the moon or Mars or somewhere else. The moon is the easiest one,
or like Europa or something. Or
yeah, that's pretty far away. So yeah, the issue we have now is getting places. Far. But yeah,
but I mean, when you look at the technology of thousands, you know,
Europa, in the future, yes. If you turn on many years, Chris, yeah,
it's
in
like
our lifetime,
leapfrogging across.
Yeah, I'm selfish. I want to see it happen in my lifetime, which is starting. You know, it's starting to run out here.
They want to drop this probe on Europa that will drill through the ice and then go underwater and look for life, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's incredible. I hope we get to see that. Is it sort of an explorer's gene that you have, or is it space specific? In other words, if someone said, "Well, you can't go to space, but you can, you know, we'll let you explore, you know, what's on the ocean floor,"
yeah,
which a lot of things we don't know are down
right
there. Does that fascinate you at all, or is it really just being above?
Honestly, not for me. I think it's really cool stuff, you know, going underwater. For me, I think the things that really motivated me were, you know, I wanted to experience what it was like to be a part of the space program and to get a chance firsthand to see what it's like to get that experience and to contribute in that way. And the other thing that I wanted to do was to be an astronaut, to be part of that organization. When I first got out of grad school, I took a job at the Johnson Space Center working for a contractor down there. And I got a chance to work with some of the astronauts. And this was the group I wanted to be a part of. A team that works together really well as a you know, close-knit camaraderie with a goal in mind. Just being a part of the office, mm-hmm, going to work. Because, you know, you spend a very little time. I've been an astronaut for 17 years. I spent about a month in space, okay? I've spent about a good deal of that training on my flights and a lot of generic training. But that's been done basically on the ground. I'm not counting airplanes flying around. That's still on the ground. They're in spacesuits. You're still on the ground. So most of your time is on the planet. And so a lot of your job is supporting your friends and that camaraderie and those friendships and being part of that organization,
yeah,
being on the front line of getting your friends ready. You know, I've been in the control room as a Capcom, helping out with planning spacewalks, assisting crews, helping them to get ready. You know, I wanted to be a part of that thing. I didn't just want to go once and that was the end of it. To me, I wanted the whole package. I wanted to be part of that organization. Wow. So that was my motivation. And I don't think, I mean, and the undersea stuff is really cool. But, you know, I'm a space guy.
Did it change you in any way, in any noticeable way? Did it change you, like, when you got back? Did you have a different perspective on things? Or did you, did you notice anything about your personality that it slightly altered?
I think, you know, you notice some things, like, you come back and you're like, the first thing, you get to the driveway, and I looked up on the roof, and I was like, when did those shingles come loose? You know? So I was like, what happened? It was like, it's like an awakening again. Like, man, I'd rather be back in space. It's but I think
not dealing with Earth stuff.
No, I think as far as the change, I would say for me, and it changed the way I look at the Earth in some way, the way I perceive the Earth. And it happened to me on my first spacewalk. The other rookie on a flight was my buddy Dwayne Carey, an Air Force pilot, and he wasn't going to get the spacewalk. And we were classmates. We were in the same astronaut group when we were selected, so we were classmates. Still one of my best friends. And his nickname was Digger, and he said, "Mass, when you go out there, I'm not going to get a chance to go out there." He goes, "I want you, as soon as you come in, I want you to tell me exactly what it's like out there spacewalking. And I don't want any BS. I want you to tell me exactly. I don't want to hear any stuff for the reporters. I want to know exactly what it's like." So I go out and do my spacewalk, and I come in. Sure enough, he comes in the airlock, and he's right in my mug. He's waiting for the signal to get my helmet off, you know. And now it's time for the helmet, and the lock comes out. The helmet's off my head, and he's right in my face, floating in front of me. He goes, "What was?" He didn't want to take any chances. I need to go to the bathroom. Nothing. I couldn't do anything. No sandwich. You know, he wanted to know, and he's like, "Mass, what was it like?" And I looked at him and said, "Digger, the Earth is a planet, right?" And he looks at me and he goes, he looked at me with the, like, "What were you smoking in that spacesuit?
Right.
Know, what the heck kind of answer that?" And I said, "Man, it's a planet. It's not what we thought it was." Like, I have this, my relationship with the Earth has been, you know, like driving around in a car, maybe going on an airplane ride is like the safe cocoon that we're in. We might go to a ball game. I come here, get to talk to you guys. We think like we're kind of safe and we're at home. It ain't that at all. And it struck me on that first spacewalk, thinking about how I was going to describe it to my buddy, is I could see the Earth off to the right side when I really looked at it, right on this one particular pass. But I could look in the right time of the orbit. I could see the moon, or I could see the stars, and the sun is out there. And I could turn back and I could see our little old Earth. Not, but it's big. Still, we're still close to it. So I could see Earth, little in comparison to everything else out there. And I realized, man, it is a planet. It's not this safe haven. It's out there with all this chaos, man. There's all this crap out here. You know, the
it's
stars,
just one of those things.
We're just one of those things, man.
Yeah.
We're space travelers. We're not in this safe cocoon. We're on the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. But we are all space travelers, and that's the way I vision the Earth now. In some ways, it's not this, you know, safe place that we take our kids to soccer practice. It is that for us, but we really are on a spaceship Earth, and that's kind of the way I look at it.
That's a fact, you know. And hearing it's so funny about perspective, because you experience that literally. So for you to say like, "Oh man, the Earth is a planet, man!"
Holy crap!
But then you know, you imagine someone just like went to a Fish concert and they're like, "Bro, the Earth is a planet."
Exactly.
Like,
yeah,
shut up. But when you say it, it's like, "Oh my God, it makes so much sense."
Yeah.
It makes so much sense.
And we know it's a planet. We learned it in school, you know. And but you know,
we're
to
all
see
just
it,
traveling.
It really
it's intellectual
me.
Knowledge. It's not. Right. It's not like experiential knowledge.
Exactly.
Like, those is different to know. Like, oh yeah. It's, but I mean, like, you don't know. You can't describe, like, if someone's never had tuna fish before, you can be like, well, it's like, you know, it's like this thing.
Have you ever eaten metal?
But it is, that's what I was saying earlier about, like, when you're describing that, you know, you're getting these images that are real images from an experience that you had, and it's, you know, like, I'm kind of weirdly jealous because I, you know, most of us, most of it will never have an experience like that. We'll never, it just that real, and obviously, you know, some people who are big nature people must understand, like, oh, we're part of a bigger thing, but but to really experience it from that vantage point is,
well,
it's pretty remarkable.
If you go to Epcot, you can ride Spaceship Earth.
Yeah, it's the same thing, Matt. It's exactly the same thing.
Well, you can get to the movies, you know, with, the IMAX Hubble movie was a good one, and now this Gravity movie.
Yeah,
with the technology it has, it looks it's as close as you can get. But yeah, to actually really experience it and see it is quite a
privilege.
That's
why I find it. So those Apollo astronauts, those guys would just stand
guys,
on the surface of another celestial body and look and see the Earth, but to see it this big.
Yeah, they could blot it out with so the station is at 250 miles. The Hubble's at 350 miles. Moon is 250,000 miles away. That's a much different perspective.
When you start talking astronomical figures, it really does sort of, like, whenever you hear, they discovered another planet that's orbiting another star that's very similar, you know, it's very similar to Earth. Millions of Earths could fit inside this one. When they start talking about, or even just the size of Jupiter.
Yeah, Jupiter. Like how many Earths? There's a bunch of Earths that can fit inside of the spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Like 13
yeah.
Earths, 30
spot,
Earths. In
the spot. Yeah.
In this spot, you can fit, like, I don't know.
It's basically like
Earths
the nostril of Jupiter.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You can fit,
exactly.
a ton of Earths.
Right.
That's so, like, when you start thinking in those terms, it's just, you can't even.
Yeah.
your brain is just like, does not compute. Like, I just get the little pinwheel and spinning in front of my face. Yeah. Like, I can't.
Really, it's beyond what we can comprehend.
250,000 miles.
A long way away from home.
That's just to the moon.
Yeah, just around a corner. That's in a neighborhood.
How far is Mars?
The sun is 90 million miles away. I don't know. It takes 19 minutes for a signal to get there at light speed. So what is that?
Somebody figure it out.
Figure that out.
How far is Mars, Katie? I'm
glad we got somebody here.
Google Foo. The internet's like, I don't know.
Well, it depends on orbit.
I guess it depends on the orbit.
Depends where we are and all that. Yeah. So it's like, and time wise, it's about you figure about a 6 month journey.
About 33.9 million miles.
There you go, 33.9 million.
A third of the way to the sun.
I mean, it is, you know,
nice.
It does, you know. How could anyone doubt science or math when they figured out how to aim an SUV at Mars? And just the planning it would take and the precision to hit the exact spot on a planet where they have to calculate for orbits and they have to calculate for the arc of the cruise of the device. I mean, like, it just – all of it – how could anyone be like, I don't know about science? Like, it's just – if science can do that
– Yep.
Just – and you're great on, like I said before, you're great on Star Talk. And I think you know, science and, you know, I think NASA's very lucky to have you. But science is lucky to have guys like you and Bill Nye and Neil Tyson who can communicate these concepts in a way that's very intelligent without talking down to people and very human and compelling and exciting and fun. And, you know, like it's a whole different skill set to have than just I am a, because there are some scientists, a lot of engineers, they don't know how to communicate to non-engineers. They're like, oh, why don't you just understand that it's this, and this? And then you're
it's obvious.
Well, but it's not obvious to everyone. So it is. I think it is an asset. I think NASA is pretty smart to have you, you know, like making the rounds and talking to people, because it's it is. You just seem like, oh, I can hang out with this guy. We'll go see Uncle Frankie. We'll work on cars.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll talk about mechanical engineering.
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
Do you have a big family?
I have a couple kids. I've got a bunch of aunts and uncles and cousins.
A bunch of aunts and uncles,
we got a pretty big family.
Man, the Italians, they just did not,
they're Catholic and, you know, condoms are evil.
Well, it's not just that, but the idea that anyone would say, like, I could probably have 12 kids. Like, you know.
No, you can't. It's too many.
They just don't stop, you know. Like, my great-grandparents were, I mean, I think... Well, I mean, my great-grandmother was a teenager when they married him. I think it was like, you know, she was like 15 and my uncle, my great-grandfather was like 19 or 20 or whatever. And they just...
How many did they have?
12. There was no adolescence in the, you know, at the turn of the 20th century.
There was no Netflix.
There was no Netflix.
Yeah.
They couldn't sit down and watch
it. They emigrated. They got here and it's like, let's get married. Let's get down to business. And they just started. They were married for 72 years.
Whoa.
Wow.
But there's a lot. Yeah. Having kids... you know, is a great thing, but that's a lot of kids. You know, that's a lot of kids. I don't know. Did they work on a farm? My father came from a big family. I think they were looking for farm hands, though.
I don't think they worked on a farm. I think they just lived in a city.
I can't milk all these cows. Let's make a kid.
Hey, we need some kids. Let's get another kid to go clean up the barn.
Very cheap labor pool.
You know, you have to understand, by the time you're 40, you've been pregnant most of your life. Most of your life, there's been a baby in you.
I want to know firsthand, but I don't think, from what I've observed, that's not easy duty.
That is not an easy thing to do.
No. That's remarkable, actually.
Way to go, Ficenis. They took the American pronunciation. It should be Facente, but they're the Ficenis, you know. It's like they did that.
They're gonna screw up your name anyway. So that's where you go with nicknames.
They went the opposite of Guy Fieri.
Yeah, exactly.
Whose last name is Ferry.
Is it really?
Ferry.
Are you serious?
To make it sound more
kidding.
Are you serious?
No, I'm not kidding. I'm serious. Yeah.
That's not.
I know.
Okay.
That's un-American.
That's right. That's right, Guy Ferry.
Un-American.
That's bullshit. Matthew Mira.
It's Myra, you motherfucker. It
dare
is Myra.
You. So what's next for you, Mike Massimino? What are you off to do? What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to head back to New York after talking to you guys. And I'm on the visiting faculty member at Columbia University this year. Yep. So that's pretty cool. I'm getting a chance to teach a space course, and we're doing looking for some cooperative research between Columbia and some of the schools in the New York area and NASA, and doing some outreach projects there as well. So that's what I'll be doing for
Do you take the
next
subway?
Few months. Anywhere I can get around to New York, man. Talk about navigation. It is celestial navigation when you're going around the stars, but holy cow. Based on the time of day and what's going on, is you have to pick the right way to get around there. So, subway.
Take the F train to the ISS.
Whatever. I don't know. You can't go up. That's why elevators only go so high.
I just love
getting
the
around
idea
Manhattan, man.
Of an astronaut on a subway.
It's the way to travel. It's the way to go. It's a good way to go. But there's other methods too. Yeah. But that's a big deal. Just like it's a big deal here in LA getting around.
Yeah, sure.
So you got to put some thought and effort into it. In Houston, it's pretty easy getting around town, getting a car and go.
There are some subway stops though where I almost imagine you do need to suit up, like you're going out into a hostile environment. I better suit up, put on the suit.
You just got to be knowledgeable of where and when you are. But New York City, when I was growing up in New York, it's a lot different. It's a clean place. It's much safer than it was when I was a kid. It's really turned, I think, for the better.
I don't have any reservations about walking around New York at 2 o'clock in the morning.
People look out for each other too.
Los Angeles, though? No.
I don't know. I'm not an LA guy, really.
You don't walk around late at night here.
I usually will walk at least from the Natural History Museum down to like Soho. Whenever I'm there, I do that whole, I just walk. Blocks and blocks.
Yeah, that's great. You can bike around. I've been riding my bike around town too.
You bike around Manhattan?
Well, not on the streets. I'm not that crazy.
Okay.
I go fly in space, but I'm not riding my bike down Fifth Avenue. No. Because there may even be a bike path there, but really what that symbol of a bike guy is a passing lane for the taxi.
Yes.
That really does not mean bike lane. That means passing lane for taxis.
By the way, and it doesn't matter
stay
if you're in that lane or not. It's still
going
to be a passing lane for the
But they have taxis. Some really nice bike trails around there in the parks that are really extraordinary. It's a really a wonderful place. I'm very lucky to be there for a little while.
I love Manhattan.
So you're on where can people reach out to you online?
Okay, so the Twitter thing is probably good, right?
Yep.
I'm astro_Mike.
Okay.
And that's my Twitter handle, and that's where you can find me.
Great.
That's where I found him.
That's where you found him?
Yeah.
I was the first dude to tweet from space.
What?
Yeah, I was the first guy to tweet from space.
Take that, Hadfield.
There you go. Yeah. Hadfield. Yeah, he's the first guy to have a full orchestra in space.
First guy to make a music video in space.
Yes.
I think.
Who
knows?
People might have made him, but not at that level.
Yeah.
When he came back, I saw him like 2 days after he came back. I said, hey, man, he had a lot of help.
Yeah.
So he had like some, he's from Canada. He had some like Canadian orchestra or something involved and editors on the ground. And it was a big operation, but he had a lot of help. But it was incredible, man. My son picked it up right away. He said, hey, Dad, you got to see this. This is really cool. So for my son to say something was cool that had to do with space, I knew it had to be something really cool.
What was your tweet from space? What was your first?
My first tweet from space was launch was awesome. I'm feeling great. The adventure of a lifetime has begun. Something like that. But the best part about that is that they made fun of it on Saturday Night Live. So my kids really didn't. My son was upset about the launch because it was conflicting with the eighth grade dance at the time.
Oh, that's
all right. So it was like, oh, I got to go. So it's like, go to your dance. Don't worry about the launch. So he went to the eighth grade dance, and then we shuffled him like immediately as soon as we get him to the launch so he could see the launch. But he was more concerned about the eighth grade dance. He had his priorities right. The kids really just like, when they were real little, they wanted a puppy. And they had to wait till after the launch. So they were looking forward to the launch so they could get a puppy. They have to bride these kids. So they were like, oh, Dad's flying in space, blah, 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 blah.
But we're going to get a dog, right?
Who cares? Right, who cares? So the thing that got them excited during my flight was not the first tweet, but that they made fun of it on Saturday Night Live. And even though they mispronounced my name, they called me Mike Massimone. They said I was at the International Space Station. Who cares? I was at Hubble, but... They said something like, the first tweet from space, launch was awesome. And they made fun of it, said something like, if we ever find life on other planets and we send this guy, this is what we'll have. And they typed out, geez, dudes, look, aliens. But even though they mispronounced my name and the kids went nuts because they were, it was referred to on Saturday Night
Live. This is good. It's very human. I'm just glad. I think it would have been funny if your first tweet was still like a picture of food, wherever you're like ham and eggs, and there's a picture of tubes.
Yeah. No, I wasn't that creative. I just got on the computer and came up with that. That's all I could do.
Astro_Mike, people should tweet out to you, Mike Massimino. Such a nice guy. Oh, man. Yeah, people are going to want to hang out with you.
You can also watch, I think, on Netflix right now. I think the Fixing the Hubble is on, the National Geographic special, I think, is still on Netflix.
Okay, cool.
Right now.
Yeah.
And Nova Science Now, when they talk about going to Mars, he checks out new future spacesuits, which don't look that great. But anyway, you did a good job. You did a good report.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Why don't they? Why don't the spacesuits look there?
A little too weird looking.
Oh, you're worried about the aesthetic.
I'm worried about the aesthetic. Yeah.
Not the technology of whether the technology, they would protect people.
The technology is viable.
Yeah.
It'll make you much more flexible and able to do more stuff in space, but they look weird.
Okay. You're being a traditionalist now. You think all spacesuits should look like.
I mean, either you wear a button-up red tunic or a real spacesuit.
You know what I realize we have here that someone sent this to us. I wish I knew. Let's see if it says. Oh, let's see if I know who made these. Okay. Visiting a friend in LA at Pages BS, PagesBS, right. Made a series of astronaut patches.
Yeah, you completed,
for our
you
podcast.
Completed.
Oh,
you
wow!
You've completed.
That's awesome.
You've
man.
Completed Nerdist training, and so
I get a patch.
Here's your patch.
Oh, cool!
Here's your mission patch.
This is awesome. Yeah. It's got the Velcro on it. I can put it on my real spacesuit.
I think Pages BS is going to flip out that that an astronaut actually has one of these.
This is cool. You know, because when I did the thing on the Big Bang Theory, it was a TV show. It wasn't a real space launch, but yeah. I said there's three things you need for a real space mission. One is a patch. So we need to get, and they got a patch together for us. Mm-hmm. They designed a patch with our names on it. So I said, need a patch. Second thing we need is a crew photo. So we took an official crew photo with the American flag. We had the Russian flag in the background. I think it's in Wallowitz's hallway or something. You can see it if you watch the show. And the third thing is a space mission. Now, we didn't get a real space mission. We've got two out of three.
You got two out of three.
So you guys are on your way.
Yep, we got one.
We got a patch.
We got to come up with a mission.
You need a crew photo.
And a crew photo.
If you can get a mission, great. But if not, you'll get two out of three.
Well, we'll take a crew photo at the end.
All right.
thanks, man. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. That's how we end the podcast. We say enjoy your burrito. Enjoy it.
In space.
Enjoy your burrito. I think you should say it, actually. You have a much
you
better.
Want me to say it?
Yeah.
What is it?
Enjoy your burrito.
Enjoy your burrito.
Yeah.
It's nice. Nice.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.